You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 15th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the show, a reversal, of course, by Obama. We'll see. Meanwhile, Scott Walker in trouble? We'll talk about it. Monsanto, boy, have they screwed up our corn. Rampant economic pessimism across the country. GOP continues to obstruct. Elizabeth Warren jumping into the race. The FBI keeping us safe from these demon-practicing Muslims. And an update on that story about Pennsylvania that we talked about yesterday. And the five myths of the would-be Solyndra scandal that Republicans will want to push. You know, the interesting thing about the Obama administration, and I would say the interesting thing about the Obama administration, and maybe also the Republicans, this has been a relatively scandal-free. I mean, the scandal is more on policy, in my estimation, but it has been a relatively scandal-free now close to 3 years of the Obama administration, despite the fact that Darrell Issa, who one would expect with all his experience in breaking into cars and potentially being involved in arson, one would expect he would be well-suited to find scandal. But no, not yet. The Solyndra thing, they may be hyping as a way of doing it, but we will get to that later in the program. Just a programming note. On Monday, we're going to be talking to her name. I think it's Susan Mettler. Is that it? She wrote a great piece a while back in the, I think it was Washington Monthly, and she's coming out with a book about tax expenditures. Just an interesting look at how people who benefit from government don't realize they're benefiting from government, or they specifically try not to grasp the idea that they're benefiting from government. Sound like a familiar theme? And hopefully next week, we were hoping to have him today, but it looks like we're going to do it next week. They're a great movie, and I wanted, you know, we were hoping to talk to him today. And so they, but I will draw your attention to this film now because I think you should all see it. It's a really interesting documentary called If a Tree Falls. And it's a POV movie on PBS about the Earth Liberation Front. And I had totally forgotten about this episode, this era, I guess, in the late 90s. Around the time of the WTO protests, there was a, and the organization still exists, sort of a loose confederation of people. But there was a lot of, and one of the questions about this film is, were these terrorist acts? It was a lot of setting to fire of SUVs, of logging interests, of environmental polluters' interests. The people were never targeted. Animals were never targeted. In fact, they went to great pains to not hurt any of those people. But property was targeted and destroyed. And fascinating film. If you get a chance, check it out. All right, let's get into this, because this has been a fascinating 24 hours in watching what's happened with the Obama administration and their perspective on the 2012 election in the wake of Tuesday's election results, both in New York 9 and in Nevada, a congressional district. What was it, the second, maybe, of Nevada? And whether or not these special elections were bellwethers, they're being taken so. This happens. And at the end of the day, that's almost the most important thing. Less what the elections really say, because we can really never determine that, and more what they are interpreted as saying. You'll remember when Kathy Hochul won in New York's 29th, was it 29th or 26th? She beat a Republican there, and she beat a Republican. It was a special election. Beat a Republican based upon running against the Ryan Medicare plan, which was to destroy Medicare. You keep the name, get rid of all the good stuff. And for the week or two following that, that theme was getting a lot of momentum. And then somebody hacked in, or I should say, Representative Wiener, incidentally, or accidentally, I should say, sent pictures of his Johnson to people, or broadcast them online on the Twitter. And everything went to hell. And in some respects, it has now come full circle. The Democrat lost in Wiener's district for the first time in ever? I don't know.
I think it's 80 years.
80 years. Ever, as far as I've been alive. Just about. And now there seems to be a new message coming out. Now, 2 days ago, the Financial Times had a piece, Obama to propose Medicare and Medicaid cuts. You know, on Monday, President Obama is going to roll out his deficit cutting plan, which he promised when he gave that speech to the joint session of Congress in delivering his jobs creation plan. And he is coming out with this plan on Monday. And the Financial Times, I guess it was yesterday, or the day before, had a piece entitled Obama to Propose Medicare and Medicaid Cuts. Barack Obama is expected to lay out a plan next week that would cut several hundred billion dollars from Medicare and Medicaid, the large government health care schemes for the elderly and the poor, as part of a pitch to cut further deficits by more than $1.5 trillion. Senior White House officials said U.S. President would base a detailed blueprint for fiscal reform to be delivered on Monday. And the thing that has been floated in terms of these Medicare cuts would include raising the Medicare eligibility age from 65 to 67, which, as we've detailed on this program, is a stupid and horrible idea. Not just horrible because it leaves 66 and 67-year-olds to try and fend for themselves in the private insurance market to get insurance, which would be horribly costly, but it doesn't save nearly any money for the federal government, and probably at the end of the day would lose money for the federal government, because some of those 65 and 66-year-olds, 67-year-olds, wouldn't get private insurance and would end up going into the system and being far more costly. Remember, when people talk about the cost of Medicare rising so fast, it's not the cost of Medicare that is rising. It is the cost of healthcare. Medicare is simply a means in which to pay for it. So the costs don't decrease. It's just that the government's not paying for this healthcare insurance directly. We end up paying for it in other ways. And in fact, the cost of Medicare is rising at a much slower rate than private insurance. And if anything, Medicare depresses, and we will get to this later in the program, but Medicare depresses the cost of healthcare because it simply pays less for it. And when I say we'll get to this later in the program, because probably in the better half of the program, we posted that that Ron Paul video, and we've gotten already over 200 comments on our YouTube channel from a lot of angry Ron Paulites who don't look. There are some ideas that Ron Paul has that I agree with. We should not be waging these wars of choice. And there are a couple other ideas. I like the fact that he supposedly is against corporate cronyism. But there's also a lot of ideas that he has that are completely half-baked and wacky. And when I talk about his responses yesterday, we'll let him die and all that. We'll get to that later in the show. But I'm actually pointing it out because it's just an idea and a belief shared by all conservatives. All Republicans, not just Ron Paul. It just so happened that Ron Paul was the only one who was asked that question. We will get to that later in the program. So 2 days ago, we hear that President Obama is going to put Medicare on the table. We know that he's put Medicare and Social Security on the table before in his negotiations with Bonaire. And Bonaire rejected, thankfully, those proposals to cut Social Security by chaining it to a different mechanism of determining inflation, and to cut Medicare by raising the eligibility age. So James Carville, and this could be the first and maybe the last time I ever mentioned his name on this program, but wrote a piece in CNN on CNN.com. People often ask me what advice I would give the White House about various things. Today I was mulling over the election results from New York and Nevada, thinking about that very question. What should the White House do now? One word came to mind. Panic. We're far past sending out talking points. Do not attempt to dumb it down. We cannot stand with any more explanations. Have you talked to any Democratic senators lately? I have. It's pretty damn clear they are not happy campers. This is what I would say to President Obama. The time has come to demand a plan of action that requires a complete change from the direction you are headed. Number one, fire somebody. No, fire a lot of people. Clinton fired people in 94. Reagan fired most of his campaign staff in 1980. It's not going to work with the same team, the same strategy, the same excuses. I know economic analysts are smart. Some work 17 hours days. It's time to show them the exit. Wake up. Show us you're doing something. Number two, indict people. There are certain people in American finance who haven't been held responsible for utterly ruining the economic fabric of our company. Demand from the Attorney General a clear status of the state of investigation concerning these extraordinary injustices. I know Eric Holder is a close friend of yours, but if his explanations aren't good, fire him too. Number three, make a case like a Democrat. When are we going to go along, while we are going along with the Republican austerity garbage? Who is making the case against it? It's not the Democrats. So far, I'm in complete agreement with James Carville. Number four, hold fast to an explanation. Stick to your rationale for what has happened and what's going to happen under your leadership. As I watched the Republican debates, I realized that we're on the brink of a crazy person running our nation. I sit in front of the television and shudder at the thought of one of these creationism-loving, global warming-denying, immigration-bashing, Social Security-cutting, clean air-hating, mortality-fascinated, Wall Street-protecting Republicans ruining my country and running my country. The course we are on is not working. The hour is late. The need is great. Fire, indict, fight. The only thing that I would make any bones of contention with in terms of what Carvel is saying here is that when we get to Social Security cutting, clean hair, air hating, Wall Street protecting, sadly, that's also an apt description of the Obama administration. And when we talk about global warming denying, they may not deny the problem, but they're not addressing the problem in the White House. So, which is why I've been saying what Carvel's been saying as of 9 months ago. Probably earlier, but you didn't hear me because I was ranting at my television. And we have all of this in the backdrop of rather, well, not surprising, I should say, but disturbing polling results that show that confidence in both parties has fallen within 20%, saying the country's on the right, only 20% saying the country is on the right course. You have nearly 73%, 72%. Of this country now, see the economy on the wrong course. That is a big problem for President Obama. Saying it's not his fault is not going to suffice. And frankly, it's not quite accurate. He was handed a shovel by the American public when he got into office. We were in a huge hole. And he more or less dug sideways. Maybe slightly up a little bit. But has not filled that hole or made the case on how to do it. In fact, he has made the opposite case. The broad message of Republicans, according to this Bloomberg poll, is resonating. With 57% of the country saying the best way to create jobs is to cut taxes and government spending. That may be the broad message of Republicans, but sadly, it's also been the somewhat obtuse message of the Obama administration. We need to tighten our belt. Really? We need to have a moratorium on payroll taxes. Really? This has also been Obama's message. So is it any wonder that the 40-some-odd percent of Republicans and then the rest of 10-15% of independents buy this message? Because no one's been arguing against it. My little perch on Mondays on the Dylan Radigan program is just not enough, folks. My bully pulpit is not bullying enough and not pulpit enough. 53% majority hold a negative view of the Republican Party, up from 47% in June. Democratic Party has also taken a hit. 46% to 44% of respondents say they have an unfavorable view of the party. There's a reversal from the plurality of 48% to 42% with a positive view 3 months ago. There are two things that we need to talk about here. Are there policy prescriptions that can be taken to create more jobs? And are there positions that can be taken to keep Rick Perry out of office? Let's save the debate as to whether or not Rick Perry would be better in office for another day. I don't really subscribe to that view. And let's save the debate as to whether or not there is a mystery candidate, our own version of Reagan Zombie, who's going to show up and save the day for Democrats. Let's save that for another day, too. Or maybe at least for another part of this program. Democrats and the president need to make a rhetorical case. They're not going to get anything through Congress or the Senate anyways. Any measures that must be taken unilaterally by the White House that involve their control of Fannie and Freddie in an attempt to help the housing market. But for the most part, you cannot rely on Congress to do anything. The Republicans will not do it. For God's sakes, they're holding up money to help people who were devastated in Hurricane Irene. Because it's not their districts. You think they're going to help the rest of the country? Of course not. Unemployment and jobs are the nation's top concern, cited by 46% of Americans, ranking ahead of the combination of the deficit and government spending at 30%. Majorities reject many specifics of Republicans' long-term plan to balance the budget. More than three quarters oppose cuts to Medicaid. 6 in 10 reject replacing the Medicare plan for the elderly with a private voucher system. 54% would raise taxes on families earning more than $250,000. Americans now, and this is stunning, congratulations, President Obama. This is what happens when a Democratic president floats this idea. And when the Democratic establishment says, well, what's the big deal? I can work till I'm 80, because all I do is sit at my typewriter. And yes, I use a typewriter. Americans are now evenly divided on gradually raising the Social Security retirement age to 69, with 49% in favor and 48% opposed. Last December, the idea was opposed 60 to 37%. But there's no bully pulpit. The president can't do anything. Nobody can do anything. It's a viable option, says Chris Nicholson, 44, a political independent and a software architect in Oakland, Tennessee. There's a political independent means one of two things. One, it means that they're a Republican, but they just like to call themselves an independent. Or two, it means I really don't spend any time thinking about politics, so I don't like to associate myself with the party. I have no idea what I'm talking about. Chris Nicholson, software architect. People live longer. My mother's 65, and there's no reason for her not to work. Presumably, she's not a janitor or a cleaning lady. As a matter of fact, she'd be working now if she could find a job. Congratulations, Chris Nicholson. You just made a great argument as to why the Social Security age should be lowered. Right now, we should have a temporary lowering of the job because your 65-year-old mother cannot find a job. Now imagine for a moment, Chris, that health insurance is not eligible. She's not eligible for Medicare until she's 67, 68. Uh-oh. I hope she doesn't get sick because she has no job. And under your plan, she has no Social Security. And under your plan, she has no health insurance. I hope they pay you well, Chris, because guess who's going to pay for it? You, sir, if not us. And talk about pulling up the ladder. Support for a higher retirement age is strongest amongst the elderly whose benefits wouldn't be affected. Even still, the majority of Americans don't want to raise this age. So with all that new information, with all that, the elections on Tuesday, the poll numbers, people like James Carville saying, change what you're doing, fire everybody, indict, and fight. We get this late yesterday from the Washington Post. As Obama prepares to present Congress on Monday with a detailed plan for taming the nation's debt, a pivotal question is, will he again proposing raising the age of Medicare eligibility from 65 to 67 and propose cuts in Social Security benefits? People close to the White House say Obama's advisors have been debating whether the plan should include these changes to Medicare eligibility age or reduction of Social Security benefits. And now Obama is unlikely to include the Social Security proposals, sources say. An administration official noted Social Security is not contributing to the nation's immediate deficit problem. The sources were less clear about whether Obama would recommend the change in the Medicare eligibility age. So this is late yesterday. And today, in the Wall Street Journal, President Barack Obama's new deficit reduction proposal will leave out changes to Social Security and may exclude any increase to the Medicare eligibility age. This is fascinating. We are watching the Obama administration over the course of literally 36 to 48 hours withdraw their proposals, at least internally, to changing, to cutting Social Security and to raising the eligibility age of Medicare. There are still a lot of Medicare and Medicaid and Medicare cuts on the table, but they are on the provider side, which, frankly, still problematic from a political standpoint, more so even than a policy standpoint. But certainly from a political standpoint, you'll remember in the 2010 election when Republicans ran on the idea that Obama had cut Medicare by $500 billion. In fact, Michelle Bachmann even raised it at the debate. Now, what he did is he simply cut it on the provider side, which was just offering less benefits, essentially, to private corporations. But they still were able to use it rhetorically. And so Ezra Klein sums it up today, and I assume at 10 a.m. he had talked to people in the White House. And he basically says, yes, they've changed. Next week we'll see if this is simply a temporary divergence from the one true path or a whole new strategy. If the White House emerges with a plan that is firmly in the middle and makes it impossible to run against Republican ideas in 2012, then we'll know they're not interested in returning to the post-Ryan strategy. And they still think being the adults in the room will win them the election. If they emerge with a plan that cuts the deficit in ways that the American people like and the Republicans can't accept, we'll know they have chosen to change direction sharply. In that world, Republicans will be left with two choices. Either give the Democrats a deal on the deficit and jobs, and make no mistake, the White House would still jump at the chance to raise the Medicare eligibility age in return for a grand bargain, or duke it out in the election. That's the funny thing about ceasing to compromise in public. It can make it more likely that you'll actually get a compromise in private. Well, I can only hope not. But that is the state of play, and we will not know. Maybe we won't even know after that, but we will not have an indication until Monday when we hear President Obama's deficit reduction plan as to which direction he's heading in. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, give you an update on what's happening with Scott Walker, and more. We'll be right back. You shouted at women, you love to, I've been crowned.
lose your mind.
We are back. So yesterday, I think it was in the was it in the post show, or was it excuse me, the better half of the program, or was it during the program that we got that Scott Walker information?
I believe that was after the regular show.
Okay, so not the regular show, the lesser of the two shows.
Lesser half.
Lesser half.
The crappy version.
So yesterday we got word during the better half of the program that, of course, we delivered to you immediately, that a Scott Walker aide had been, who recently resigned, had been paid a visit by FBI investigators, and they seemed to take a lot of property out of her house. Boxes, records, computers. And I had heard through a little birdie, of which I did not have a sound effect for, that there were similar, not quite raids, but investigations going on with other Walker staffers. I did a little digging, and on Tuesday, at the blog Cognitive Dissidence, a Wisconsin blogger, they had this story. Cindy Archer, and this is the woman who was the subject of this FBI raid yesterday, who was the head of then county executive Scott Walker's. Now, yesterday we didn't know exactly what it was. They're looking at some former advisors of Scott Walker, Governor Scott Walker. But it turns out this is not about him being governor. It's about what he did when he was county executive of Milwaukee County. Now, folks, I know this is going to be very hard for you to believe. I know this is probably going to flip your entire world on its head. The idea that Scott Walker, who would do the bidding of the Koch brothers, take their phone call, kiss their ass, attack Wisconsinites, attack unions, the fact that this guy would be unethical in private like he is in public, I know that must be shocking to you. And the fact that they would ram through that bill in a complete flouting of the law, saved only by the fact that the choker, Supreme Court of Wisconsin Prosser, ruled that, no, they were fine doing what they did. The fact that they would break the law in that way in public would not necessarily, you would never imagine he would do it in private. Well, Cindy Archer, who was the head of then County Executive Walker's Department of Administration, then followed him to Madison, is the most recent game piece for Walker in his game of musical chairs. Last month, the day after another crony, Tom Nardelli, announced his sudden retirement, it was learned that Archer was also leaving her position. She claimed it was to take leave to attend personal matters. It was speculated that the two sudden departures were tied to the still ongoing John Doe investigation. Apparently, there's a John Doe federal grand jury investigation happening in Wisconsin that no one really had a sense of what was behind it. Walker apparently, it turned out that when Archer had left her county executive position, Walker had already given her another job in the state government with a 61% raise over the person who filled it before. She quit again on August 19th. She was making $124,000 as deputy secretary in the State Department of Administration, the agency that oversees state contracts, the state budget, and the state workforce. Nobody knew why she left. All they knew is that the last person to hold that position, Kimberly Collins, was paid $61,000 a year in 2010. Is that only a 61% increase? That seems weird. So, 2 days later, one day later, probes surrounding Wisconsin governor apparently growing. The raid was on a former top aide to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker in what appears to be an expanding corruption investigation. Even though the search warrant was executed, and here is the tip-off, even though the search warrant was executed on a home in the state capital, Madison, they were Milwaukee FBI agents. Which is why we know that this has to do with Scott Walker's time as the Milwaukee County Executive. Archer had followed Walker to the governor's office last November after she was his top county staffer in Milwaukee. Walker's Milwaukee chief of staff, Nardelli, also followed to the Capitol and, like Archer, also quit his $90,000 new state job this summer. The grand jury-like investigation appears to be targeting ex-employees of Governor Walker, with the focus being on their activities while working in Milwaukee County and suspicions they did public work, political work on public time. Two previous raids, federal raids on Walker staffers, ended with the seizure of work computers. We'll be following this closely, ladies and gentlemen, but if I was Scott Walker, I would be getting a lawyer. Oh, what's that? Scott Walker has lawyered up. Scott Walker has lawyered up. In fact, he has gotten one of the corrupt former U.S. attorneys implicated in the entire Karl Rove scandal to represent him. I mean, not because he's got any legal issues. It's just, the best time to get a lawyer is when you don't need one. That's what they always say, folks. And finally, since you're all going to hear about this quite a bit. Oh, let me update this on the Pennsylvania. I guess we'll have to save for the better half of the show. These myths about the Solyndra thing. Yesterday on the program, was it on the better half or on this side? I think I talked about the...
It was in the better half.
Oh, well, sorry, folks. The Pennsylvania Republicans who control the House and the governorship and the Senate in Pennsylvania are looking to change the way that Pennsylvania hands out its electoral votes. They will join only Maine and Nebraska, two smaller states with far less electoral votes, in doling out their electoral votes based upon the congressional districts that the presidential candidate carries. I saw numbers on what would have happened if you went backwards into elections, and it would have quite a bit of impact. It would cost probably Democrats in Pennsylvania, Democratic presidential candidate, anywhere from 10 to 12 of Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes. Because in Pennsylvania, Democrats do better in urban areas, which are far more populous and denser than in the rural areas. And they tend to run up the popular votes in those areas. However, as often happens in politics, it seems that their incentives and their agenda is not aligned so well with their federal counterparts. Politico reports a proposal to change how Pennsylvania awards its Electoral College votes is now pitting state government leaders in Harrisburg against fellow Republicans in the U.S. Congress. To several Republicans in marginal districts, the plan has a catch. They're worried that Democrats will move dollars and ground troops from solid blue districts to battlegrounds in pursuit of electoral votes, and in the process, knock off the Republicans currently in those seats. So the idea would be that it would cost you electoral votes as the president, but you're not going to put your money into Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and some of the urban areas, rather, to run up the votes there so you can win the state. Instead, because you know you're going to win those districts, you start to pour money into suburban districts where maybe some of these Republican lawmakers are not so solid. We would no longer be, and so the Republicans now are coming up with more excuses now not to do this, now that they've found that, like, oops, some of our buddies are a little bit uptight about it. We would no longer be a battleground state with all the benefits that come with that, said state GOP chairman Rob Gleason, who is also now opposed to the plan. It would affect us all the way down the ticket. We're going to win the presidency here anyway, so why would we do this now? We're at the top of the heap is beyond me. Meanwhile, Democratic Chairman Jim Burns said, if this happens, we're going to see resources otherwise used in Philly and Pittsburgh shifted to suburban districts, which change the entire statewide stage. What you're going to see from the party, labor, and local committees is a shift in our focus in targeting congressional districts. So much for the best laid of plans by state Republicans. All right, folks, let's head into the better half of the program. We'll be talking about Monsanto. We'll be talking about Solyndra. We'll be talking about this FBI story, what they're teaching their agents about Islam. Elizabeth Warren is running. Ladies and gentlemen, you can join me in the better half of the program if you become a member. I see how many of you are listening now on a more regular basis. Would you want this show to go away? What would you listen to? The crickets? To become a member, simply go to majority.fm, 33 cents a day. And I'm talking weekdays, not even weekends. What can you buy for 33 cents? Nothing. You can't buy a pack of gum for 33 cents. Just don't press on the gas so hard when you're driving to work. You'll save 33 cents a day. Please, cut back on your texting. You'll save more than 33 cents. Become a member today. I need your support, folks. It's the only way I can do it. Majority.fm. And as always, support justcoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, chocolate. 10% discount. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Want to call into the better half of the show? Number 646-257-3920. We'll also talk about those crazy Ron Paulites on our YouTube. Oh, it's going to be a great after show. You can listen to it tomorrow once you become a member. All right, folks. See you then. You can IM me at Majority FM, of course, too.